From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Climate change can be difficult to understand, and figuring out what to do about it can be even harder.
How do we get rid of the greenhouse gases?
Fortunately, our handsomest politicians came up with a cheap, last-minute way to combat global warming. Ever since 2063, we simply drop a giant ice cube into the ocean every now and then.
This hour will break down the hows and whys of climate change. First, though, we talked last week about Georgia's coyote challenge. Starting tomorrow, the state will offer rewards to hunters who bring in coyotes they've hunted.
There are estimates that there are 100,000 coyotes killed every year in this country, if not more. We're not influencing the coyote population. It is not our role to try to beat these numbers back. These numbers will stabilize themselves.
That's biologist and co-founder of the Atlanta Coyote Project, Chris Mowry. Here are your first thoughts.
This is Hovie Smith. I live in rural Georgia near Sandersville. And every full moon, I have packs of coyotes running on my property. And of course, I attempt to engage them anytime I can. I have taken an occasional coyote while turkey hunting. I've taken them during deer season. And we really need fewer of these things. I have found kills on deer that they've made. And they've also in the past killed at least one of my dogs. So I have no great love for them. I don't want to see them absolutely all gone, but we could surely use fewer of them.
We also got an email from Pam Wiggum in Watkinsville. She says, quote, I don't see them often, but I spotted a coyote earlier this morning crossing our wooded property along a trail where the deer also travel. Then serendipitously, OST aired a segment about the southern coyote today. Thanks to your guest, I learned much, especially about coyotes' breeding and social structure, and believe that the state's hunting contest is a really bad idea, end quote. Yesterday, we chatted with filmmaker Reed Van Dyke on his short film, DeKalb Elementary, which is a fictionalized account of a near-miss school shooting here in Georgia. And we got a Facebook comment from Jackson Faw, quote, a school administrator disarmed a shooter inside an Atlanta area middle school with her words, not a gun. This is what our teachers are for. I can't wait to see this film, end quote. We love getting your thoughts, so give us a call at 404-500-9457. We're also on the Twitter. It's at OST Talk, or find us on Facebook. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. This weekend, an Atlanta institution will pay tribute to the heroines of Sesame Street. We'll talk to one of them today. But first, let's meet one of the most recognizable characters on the show. You might not recognize his name, but chances are you'll know his voice.
I'm a bird and I'm big, yes, I'm one tall fellow. I'm covered in feathers that are fluffy, that are yellow. I'm Big Bird, yes, my initials are BB. I'm glad to be the way I am. So glad to be the way I am. I'm glad to be the way
I am. Charles Spinney plays Big Bird on Sesame Street and also does the voice of Oscar the Grouch. He's been with the show since its inception in 1969, and I spoke to him in 2015 as he was preparing for Dragon Con in Atlanta. You know, I read a story about you, and I hope you tell me if it's true. I heard that when Jim Henson first approached you and said, I want to talk to you about the Muppets, you didn't realize he was talking about a job, and so you didn't get back to him.
That's true. That was 1963, I think, or two.
How long? 62. How long did it take before you finally realized he wanted to employ you?
Well, the next time I met him was... in 1969, and he was scouting for someone to play Big Bird and Oscar. And he said, why don't you come down to New York and talk about the Muppets? And I heard that before, so I said, and you mean what? He said, you know, talk about working with me. I said, oh, wow, sure.
Now, the kind of character he was imagining for Big Bird, this is something you talk about in your memoir, was kind of almost like a Barney the Dinosaur sort of... hale, hearty guy, and you changed that to make Big Bird more childlike. Why did you make that change?
Well, Jim's conception of him was that he'd always wanted to make a silly, goofy bird. Wanted to be really funny because he's so goofy. And he said, picture Mickey Mouse's pal Goofy as a kind of a character. And that's the way the bird sounded to start with, you know. And as we were doing the show, I don't know whether it was a few weeks or a few months into the show, a script came along where Big Bird sees a bunch of children going into a thing that turns out to be a school for little children. And I thought, and Big Bird really wanted to go in, and he does a foot-stomping anger because he couldn't go in. I thought, well, that would be a disturbing thing if he's just a big goofy guy. But instead, if he's a kid, why can't he be in there? So I decided that it would be more useful for the show if he was a child. And that they readily agreed. And gradually, I changed it over a week or so from a voice of deeper sound and to a light, more childlike voice.
You're going to meet all kinds of people like me who geek out over the fact that you taught me how to read. But I wonder how do kids react? I mean, kids may not entirely grasp that there's somebody inside the Big Bird costume. Do they understand that you are Big Bird when they meet
generally
you?
Generally, 5 or 6 years old is when they have either been instructed that there is a man in there or they just figure it out. But I frankly believe that it's the delightful part of being a child is that you can believe in things that are more magical. And it was Jim Henson's idea that I don't do any, people wanted to get a picture of me half in the bird and half out. And he said, that just destroys a lot of illusions. And he felt that it really would be good not to not do shots like that, which photographers were constantly pursuing me to get a shot like that.
I bet.
And I agreed 100%. And I think it worked out much better. I frankly think if he had continued to be just a goofy guy, he really would have been not there 46 years later.
Is it a blessing or a curse that you can be anonymous? I mean, let's be frank. You're like one of the most famous people in America. Your characters, your career has certainly lasted longer than, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio or a movie star. So, I mean, is it a blessing or is it a kind of a curse that when you walk around the street, you can do so pretty anonymously?
Well, I think that that the latter, what you said, is true. I've been asked by journalists, does it frustrate you that Big Bird is so famous, nobody knows you from Adam? And I said, but I think that's probably one of the good things about it, is that anonymity allows you just to be another person, which is fine. I think people are great. I'm part of them, and I'm a person. And so recently somebody had seen me on a TV thing. The next day she sees me standing in front of her building in New York. She stopped, gasped, aren't you somebody? I said, well, of course, everybody's somebody. And I said, well, I think you're talking about Sesame Street, perhaps, and she said, exactly. And because I kind of, it was easy to assume that.
Now, one of the things I love about Big Bird is how well you handle really serious topics. You know, one of the first things I remember was the death of Mr. Hooper.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a highlight to me of one of the greatest things we did.
Yeah, just amazing.
I'm still working, and I still do it, by the way.
And, you know, the discussion that must have gone on, whether, I mean, because many shows would have just written him out. He moved to another state.
That's just up to the producers and the writers. The writers and producers are terrific, what they do. There's so much work. Producer is a person who sees that it gets done, but also has so many thoughts, and they're often writers themselves. And they made a really great decision when they started the show, which was that it is going to be educational, yes, but it has to be just as funny as it is educational. And so I think that was the secret to the success of Sesame Street. It's genuinely funny.
Well, because I remembered so clearly, especially Big Bird's response to Mr. Hooper's death, that's what I thought of when I saw footage of Jim Henson's funeral, and they chose you to sing Kermit's song, It's Not Easy Being Green. Let's take a listen to you singing that.
It's not easy being green. It seems you blend in with so many other ordinary things, and people tend to pass you over, 'cause you're not standing out like flashy sparkles on the water or stars in the sky.
I don't know how you made it through that without breaking, but to me it was almost as though the voice of Big Bird was exactly the right choice for
that. Well, you know, it was Jim's oldest son, Brian, who said when they were talking about Jim had planned his own, he wrote some number of things and actually had selected the songs and things that would be good for a funeral if something happened. And he didn't want to be a sad funeral. He advised us to all wear bright colors. I believe Steve Whitmire, who is a resident of Atlanta, great fellow. He's now Kermit the Frog. He was, I think, in a bright lime green suit, you know, instead of all us all in black and somber. But Brian Henson said, "Would I sing Jim the Frog's sort of his? It became his
anthem."
Big song, his anthem. That's right. And so I was very, I was delighted that to do it. Other than what delight you could have of losing one of the most amazing people I ever met.
So let me ask about, before we go, let me ask about the big headline about Sesame Street, which is that the shows will be initially aired on HBO first. And I know that, the talent on the show is not involved in a lot of those contractual decisions, but I wonder what concerns you? Is there anything where you're thinking, well, I hope this remains the same, or I hope this change doesn't happen?
I think that, frankly, the real theme of Sesame Street, it was willing to change right from the start, if needs were to be done, if something had need to be changed or improved on, or times change. Imagine we're 46 years, we've run 45 years on the air, 46 have been recorded. We haven't showed one set yet. Pardon me. And but I think that's excellent that HBO is part of the arrangement. And must have been a frog I ate. So, one thing is, it's going to be a much needed infusion of funds.
Yeah.
And it's been a struggle for years for the company, because there's so many other children's shows that sell toys, and it's the toy sales that keep the show going.
That's Carol Spinney. He's the puppeteer inside Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch on Sesame Street. I spoke to him in 2015. Just ahead, we'll meet Sonia Manzano. She played Maria on Sesame Street for more than 40 years. Later in the show, we'll talk about climate change. What is it and why is it not weather? This is On Second Thought.
Here comes the sun, doo-doo-doo-doo. Here comes the sun. Say it's all right.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. For more than 40 years, Sonia Manzano lived on Sesame Street. She played Maria, who taught her young viewers some of life's most important lessons, and she had a knack for storytelling.
Hi, I'm waiting for Maria, and I'm very excited. I can't wait till she gets here, because it's story time.
Hi, Big Bird. Ready
Hi,
for
Maria.
Your story?
Oh, yeah, I can't wait.
Okay, now which one of these should I read today?
Well, you know, I've read all of them many times. I'm tired of them. Maybe you could make me up a story.
And she did. Sometimes this week, Sonia Manzano comes to Atlanta's Center for Puppetry Arts. She's there for an event paying homage to the women of the Jim Henson Company. Sonia, it is a true honor.
Thank you. It's nice to talk to you.
I want to play a clip for you because, you know, I'm not going to fangirl all over you, but you must meet women like me all the time for whom you were one of their earliest female adult mentors. And so I want to play this clip where you're again talking to Big Bird, and you're talking about asking for a raise.
I'm trying to figure out the right way to go in there and ask Luis to give me a raise.
Oh, I see. Maria?
Huh?
What's a raise?
Well, it means that I'm going to ask him to pay me more money for the work I do in the fix-it shop.
Oh, that's very important.
Yeah, you're telling me.
How conscious were you of being that kind of role model for millions of young girls?
Well, I was very conscious about it, and I have recently seen that Sesame Street bit, and it really is wonderful, and it's so carefully written. And there was a lot of research went into it to exactly what we wanted to say to young women. And you're not the first woman to point out that segment. I've met many women 20 years younger than I who have said to me, seeing that segment made me want to get a job when I grew up and make money. So it was in the heyday of the feminist movement when Sesame Street decided to really address that issue. And I'm glad you brought that up. I totally had forgotten about it. And it's a very good bit.
And there were many that were like that, frankly. You were about to say something.
Yes. There were many. I remember I had lots of issues with Oscar the Grouch at that time on network television. We were watching All in the Family, so he was a bit Archie Bunker-ish. We would be inspired by everything else that we were watching on television, and he would, you know, in a kind of a In a way a preschooler could understand, Maria would be offended if he would call her little lady. She would be offended when he pacified her by giving her flowers. Maria got a job as a construction worker once.
Yeah.
So there were very subtle messages and kind of overt messages as well. But, you know, that show, Sesame Street, always was inspired by what was going on in the social fabric of the country.
And you weren't just a role model for young women, and I'm sure for many young men as well, but you were a pretty important and very early role model for people of color and young women of color. I wanted to play this comment from the bilingual children's book author Graciela Tiscarino Sato, who grew up watching Sesame Street, and here she is talking about seeing you speak in both Spanish and English on Sesame Street for NPR.
Because I didn't see my mom doing that. I mean, she wasn't gathering the neighborhood kids and the guy who lived in the trash can telling stories. You know, that was on TV. She had that role of the neighborhood storyteller, and that she could speak in Spanish, and then she would switch over and tell you how you say it in English. And I needed that.
So here is a woman who went on to become an award-winning children's book author, and she's literally telling NPR that you were part of her inspiration. How do you do both that serious work and still make it entertaining?
I think that I always remembered myself watching television as a little girl. I was born and raised in the 50s in New York, and I watched a lot of television. I watched shows like Leave It to Beaver and Father Knows Best, shows that you can see on TV Land now, shows of the 50s. And, of course, they never had any people of color on those shows, and Latinos were invisible in the media. It was like we did not exist. And I remember wondering how I was going to what I was going to contribute to a society that didn't see me, because obviously I wasn't seen if I wasn't reflected in the media. So I remember that feeling, and when I got the opportunity of leaving that for young girls in the late 60s, I ran with it. The show wanted me to do that. They kept telling me they wanted Latino girls to finally have someone that they could relate to. So it was very important to me to send the exact right message. Now, Did I think about everything Maria did and said? No, I thought the way to go is be as sincere as possible. And I think that Maria is really Sonia, a better Sonia, a more, she's Sonia on purpose.
I'm speaking with Sonia Manzano, who for more than 40 years played Maria on Sesame Street. She will be at Atlanta's Center for Puppetry Arts this weekend for an event celebrating the women of the Muppets. So let's find out, if you will, how they did that, or how Jim Henson did that specifically, because what we see often, especially in media companies, is they will hire a diverse talent, women and people of color, but they're not empowered. And it sounds like you're saying you were empowered. Your opinion was listened to and even followed sometimes.
Yes.
How did they do what so many, most companies have failed to do?
Well, I think that they hired people to, with the idea of, I'm hiring you to tell me what I don't know. I already know what I know. I want to know what you know. Most people now hire people who agree with them and don't take any projects further. Jim Henson would hire people, let's say, like Richard Hunt, who was a zany, sometimes difficult puppeteer, but his talent was so great and he brought so much to the table that you, is tolerate the right word? That you kind of accepted all of the eccentricities that came along with it.
And Richard Hunt was Scooter, Richard Hunt, Janice, Beaker,
right,
I think.
Forgetful yeah. Jones. He yeah. was Forgetful Jones on the show. Kevin Clash, who was the original Elmo, was also kind of tossed the puppet and said, see what you can do with it. And, you know, allowed to do that. Fran Brill was, of course, Prairie Dawn, the little girl megalomaniac that was such a hilarious character on the show. And they and I even tried puppeteering for a while, but I had absolutely no talent for it. But they were interested in giving me a shot. I think that's what made the show great and what certainly makes Jim Henson great, even at a time when not a lot of women wanted to be puppeteers.
You got during the show, you got to talk to a lot of really famous people. I want to play a clip of you speaking to another Sonia, Sonia Sotomayor, who's a U.S. Mm-hmm. Supreme Court justice. She had some tea with you, so here's a little clip of that.
This is my friend, Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
Hi, everybody.
Un cafecito?
Sí, gracias.
Finally, justice will be served.
Well, hey, baby bear.
Hi. Hey, I heard that there was a Supreme Court justice on Sesame Street.
There is, baby bear. There is.
Hi, baby bear. I am Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, but you can call me Justice.
What it must have been like for you to meet that, you know, so many people who ended up doing Sesame Street when there were other appearances they would not do.
Right, right. Well, I don't mind telling you that I had a lot to do with that, you know,
sure.
introducing her to the show, because I knew her off the show. I met her through someone else. And I also wrote that bit. I'm not going to be shy or self-effacing. I was very happy to write that bit and be instrumental in getting her on the show. We teasingly call each other the other Sonia from the Bronx. She calls me that and I call her that. And I think that was probably one of the most wonderful moments that I had on Sesame Street.
Why was that one of the most wonderful?
Well, the fact that she was a Supreme Court justice, this was more than being, not more important, but somehow more, you know, a part of the constitutional fabric of the United States. And she happened to be a New Yorker just like me, in addition to also having the same name. And I don't know, it just kind of was, I don't want to say more important than Celia Cruz or Tito Puente and Ray Barreto, when those Latino stars were were on the show, and I was Sonia was kind of a step up, a serious step up.
So your mission was manyfold, right, on Sesame Street. I mean, even though, especially with Jim Henson at the helm, it was in the end always about entertaining both kids and the parents that had to sit and watch with them, right? But there were all these other things that, because it was children, you had to be aware of. And one thing that not only Sesame Street did, but that Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers, talked about a lot was comforting children in times when they might be afraid. I want to play a clip from the show, the special that Sesame Street ran after 9/11. And there was a fire at Hooper's store on the show. Elmo got very scared, and so a firefighter showed up and showed Elmo his protective gear.
This helmet protects my head in case something heavy falls on it. And this mask, well, sometimes in a fire, there's lots of smoke.
There was a lot of smoke at Hooper's store, remember?
Yeah.
And if I breathe in too much smoke, it can make me sick. So I carry my own air in this tank, and if I need it, I breathe it in through this mask. How do I look?
Okay.
What? Mm-hmm. Yeah, how do you go about so carefully crafting a show like that?
Well, that was a four-part show. As you mentioned, it was right after 9/11, and the four segments were bullying, tolerance, loss, and the fear, which is what the segment you just showed addressed. And these were feelings that children were having, and as they were watching coverage on television of that horrible event, and of course a lot of research came in, and they said kids, you know, they see all these firemen and they could be frightening, the smoke could be frightening, so let's clarify that. You start off from a very specific place, very specific goals, with a research department who says this is what the kids should come away, the information the kids should come away with. And then the writers have to make it funny or charming or whimsical or appealing. So it's more than a pamphlet that any government agency might produce for children.
Can you remember a time when you Sesame Street may have gotten it wrong or not quite right?
Yes. They did a show on divorce, and the Snuffleupagus's parents were getting a divorce. They went through great expense to produce this show, and then they tested it with kids, and kids came away with, anybody who sleeps on the sofa means they're going to get a divorce. So they never showed it.
Mm.
That was when they didn't succeed there. And also when they expanded the cast, the show around the corner, and they made the street very big, there were too many characters then. And they pulled the show back. And I think that's to their credit. Not a lot of people will make a big expansion on the show and then admit that it wasn't the greatest idea. He said, look, it's not working. The kids, it's too confusing. You know, we have to keep them. They are our masters, so we have to cut back on the show. And they did that. They pulled the show back.
So my last question is, why do you think Sesame Street has lasted as long as it has? It's still, I mean, it's on HBO now. It's still pulling in very, very good numbers. Why?
I think the Muppets are certainly the heart and soul of the show. I think that people relate to their zaniness, their irreverence. Because it always amazes me that they love the show in China and they love the show in Japan. It's a very American show. But everybody likes the idea of going crazy and losing control, you know, in a safe environment. And certainly we are associated with very good human role models. And the show is smart. It's a children's show, but it retains the smartness that it always has. I fear that a lot of children's shows now are very, very so concerned with teaching proper messages that they kind of lose their sense of fun and humor and smartness that an adult can watch with it, with the child. And I think Sesame Street always has that underlying wink at the camera.
That's Sonia Manzano, who played Maria on Sesame Street for more than 40 years. She will be at Atlanta's Center for Puppetry Arts this Saturday at 7 p.m. for an event that celebrates the women of the Muppets. Sonia, thank you so much.
Sure thing. Looking forward to seeing everybody in Atlanta.
Just ahead, you will really understand climate change. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee.
Surprise, Celeste. We know the official GPB goodbye observance was yesterday, but this one is from a smaller circle. We who've had the pleasure and rewards of helping you make this show.
This is Maura Curry. As someone just getting her start in this business, it's been an absolute honor and privilege to work with you. Thank you for your warmth, your patience, your willingness to bring me onto the team in the first place. Being trusted to put words in your mouth and help shape your conversations has been an absolute gift.
Hey, Trevor Young here. I've said it 1,000 times, but I wouldn't be here without you. You took a big chance on a pretty green kid not long out of music school, no less. You taught me how to speak, how to listen, how to present myself, and how to grab life by the, you know. You're always yourself, and that's refreshing. The world of public radio desperately needs more people like you. So keep on keeping on, man. I'll miss you.
This is Sean Powers. You brought me onto the show before we were even on the air. I've learned so much from you. You have showed me the way a talk show can bring people together from so many different communities in such a diverse state. I've had the honor to travel all over the state on behalf of On Second Thought to tell their stories. I will forever cherish that.
And this is Don Smith. That music, as I don't have to tell our own operatic soprano Celeste, is by Verdi. Va pensiero, fly thoughts on golden wings, which is what will accompany her as she heads for some richly deserved time to relax and the next chapter in an already distinguished career. Golden thoughts and best wishes and an eternal place in our hearts.
Tomorrow we talk with Kevin Barnes. He's frontman for the quintessential Athens indie band of Montreal. You may know them from songs like this.
Let's pretend we don't exist. Let's pretend we're in Antarctica. Let's have bizarre celebrations. Let's forget when forget what forget how. We'll have bizarre celebrations.
That is Wraith, Pinned to the Mist, and Other Games by Of Montreal. We'll talk with Barnes about their brand new album called White is Relic, Irrealis Mood. It comes out next week. But first, we want to hear from you. What are your favorite indie bands and songs from Georgia or anywhere else? Call us and let us know at 404-500-9457. And then be sure to join us for that conversation tomorrow at 9 a.m. Georgia saw some record low temperatures this weekend, so you might be surprised to hear that 2017 was the warmest year on record for our state.
It is super hot. Yeah. It's getting real hot around here.
And just about every state in the nation saw temperatures above average. The long-term trend for our climate is toward higher temperatures. The planet is warming. That's part of climate change. Climate change is not well understood. And that's partly because it's so politicized. But that phrase does have a scientific meaning, totally separate from politics or punditry. And because people don't seem to understand what climate change is or what it means, it's time to break it down.
Break it down, break it down, baby, because I want y'all all to know. Let me break it down for you again.
Break it down now.
Break it down.
Climate climate change is a change in the weather patterns of a region, but that doesn't mean a change from 50 degrees today to 60 degrees tomorrow.
Now I'm cold. Crank up the thermostat. Ah, wonderful. Hotter than blazes in here. But wait, I can turn the heat down.
One of the most common mistakes when it comes to climate change is to confuse climate with weather. So first, let's make sure we understand what weather is. How many times have you heard some version of this comment?
In case we have forgotten, because we keep hearing that 2014 has been the warmest year on record, I asked the chair, you know what this is? It's a snowball. And that's just from outside here. So it's very, very cold out, very unseasonal. So here, Mr. President, catch this.
That's Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma making a common mistake during a speech to the Senate in 2015. Inhofe thinks that because snow still exists, global warming must be false.
I'm not going to stand here, present some egghead scientific argument based on fact. I'm just a regular dude. I like to drink beer, you know? I love my family. Rock, flag, and eagle, right, Charlie? He's got a point. No, he doesn't.
What? Weather is what you see and feel when you go outside each day. Is it raining? Is there a hurricane? Is it cold, hot, or humid? That's the weather.
It's raining sideways!
Sounds rough, Ollie. Do you have an umbrella?
Had one!
Where is it?
Inside out, 2 miles away!
Is there anything we can do for you?
Bring me some soup!
What kind?
Chunky!
All right, we'll get on that.
It changes constantly, on a daily or even hourly basis. Climate changes over hundreds or thousands of years. Weather is a current condition. Climate is a trend. It may be cold and dry on a given day in Atlanta, for example, but the city's climate is generally humid and warm.
Hey, look here, man. Atlanta made for business, okay? Our airport's only 20 minutes away from downtown.
2 hours for traffic.
We had the Olympics there back in 96.
The one with the bomb.
And you know, Atlanta has these wonderful places where people from all walks of life come together.
It's called the Waffle House.
The climate in the Amazon rainforest, measured over hundreds of years, is hot and sticky, and the weather is the same. The coldest month is February at about 86 degrees, and the hottest month is October at about 89 degrees. But in most places, the weather is quite different from the climate. Climate change is often used interchangeably with global warming, but they're not necessarily the same thing.
You're probably wondering why your ice cream went away. Well, Susie, the culprit isn't foreigners. It's global warming.
Global warming?
Yeah.
During an ice age, climate change trends toward cold temperatures. In fact, the Earth tends to swing between cold climate and warm. There have been 5 significant ice ages in the Earth's history. In some places, the ice was 12,000 feet thick.
You ever climbed it before?
No. Well, it's a long way up and a long way down, but I've waited my whole life to see the world from up there.
But just to demonstrate how extreme any change in the Earth's temperature is, let me point out that the average temperature during the last ice age was only 4 degrees lower than it is today.
What killed the dinosaurs? The ice age!
A 1 degree rise or drop in our planet's temperature is a very big deal. Some climate change is perfectly natural. A volcanic eruption can change the climate, for example.
Rescue personnel are starting to arrive. I know this sounds crazy, but it almost looks like lava, volcanic lava pouring onto the stream.
But in recent years, climate change has not been entirely natural. The Earth is heating up more than it should. And that's largely because of the use of fossil fuels for energy production. When you burn oil or coal, carbon dioxide is released and trapped in our atmosphere, and that causes the air to get hotter.
It's so damn hot. Milk was a bad choice.
And that means we are currently seeing anthropogenic climate change, or climate change caused by human activity. As you might imagine, though, we are not experts in climate change. And so let's bring in one of those. So joining us now to talk about climate change is Dr. Marshall Shepard, director of the Atmospheric Sciences Program at the University of Georgia. Hi, Marshall.
Good morning.
Did we get that right?
You got that absolutely right. You welcome to my world. I deal with all of that all of the time.
And I have to imagine mistaking climate for weather is the number one problem, right?
Oh, sure. Whenever there's cold weather or a snowstorm, I'll have someone tweet me and say, hey, Dr. Shepard, I've got 10 inches of global warming in my yard. What are you guys talking about climate change? I mean, that's a cute tweet, but it just really illustrates that misunderstanding of weather versus climate.
Which is not a surprise. I mean, the science education in the United States, there's a lot of areas of science that are not quite as understood as they might be. But I would imagine one of the problems for a science educator like yourself is that the skepticism about accepted science.
Yeah, you know, one of the things, and I write a contribution to Forbes, and I dealt with this recently, people shape their perceptions on science based on their ideological beliefs, their religion, their political beliefs, and misunderstanding. And so because of that, you'll have people that will shape their entire view on climate change, not based on the science at all.
So climate change, when it comes to climate change, how do we make connections between some of the anomalies we're seeing in weather? How do we know when those are connected to climate change and when they're not?
Well, there's actually a new branch of our science called attribution, and I actually co-authored a study with the National Academy of Sciences in last year, and there are ways and methods that scientists are now using to attribute extreme weather in a current context to climate change. Now, I will emphasize that often a mistake I see in the media and the public is people will say, oh, was that hurricane or that wildfire caused by climate change? That's an ill-posed way of framing it. A better way of framing it is to say, are these events becoming more frequent or intense because of climate change? Because causation sort of creates an issue in terms of how you can actually prove that. But I think we can establish with the science increases in frequency or intensity.
And that's one of the things that is complicated enough to confuse people, which is that, and then it's one of the areas in which global warming is in some ways different from climate change, because climate change can include even cold storms. It's not necessarily all hot temperatures.
Yeah, absolutely. People, you know, I often say when people say, oh, you guys changed the name from global warming to climate change to try to get over on us. That's not the case. What I often say is you wouldn't describe the flu by saying you just have a fever. That's just certainly one symptom of the flu. Global warming, meaning the warming of temperatures globally, and I often emphasize this, just because it was cold where you live in Albany, Georgia. It's not called Albany, Georgia warming. It's called global warming. So it's the global temperature change. But that's just one aspect of the various changes we see. And as you noted, changes on the cold side are certainly a part of that as well.
And so the other thing that I tried to express is how incredibly impactful even a tiny change in the global temperature is. How much of a fraction of a degree does the planet have to warm in order for us to see real changes in our sort of day-to-day life?
Well, we're already seeing it. I mean, we're at 1 degree Celsius of warming, and we talk about Fahrenheit here in the U.S. So 2 to 4 degrees Fahrenheit of change will be felt in our climate system. There will be ripples in terms of sea level rise, changes in Arctic ice, where disease-bearing mosquitoes from the tropics can live, changes in our agricultural productivity, national security threats. So the emphasis is that things are happening now, and we're going to only see a ramping up of that. That's why it was so important for us to be involved in the sort of Paris Agreement, because the Paris Agreement is trying to limit that warming at really below 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming. And we're headed rapidly towards that. Even if we shut off emissions completely today, we're still going to get there likely.
And yet there were one of the criticisms of the Paris Agreement was that it just didn't go far enough.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there are some scientists, I'm not one of them, that suggest that we're already past some critical tipping points in our climate system where things will be irreversible. I mean, if you just look at what just happened this past week, it is complete darkness roughly at the North Pole because it's winter, yet the temperatures up in the North Pole were off the charts warm the past week. Scientists like myself were literally stunned. Meanwhile, you had snow in Rome, Italy this week. So these weather extremes on both ends of the spectrum, cold and warm, extreme drought and heavy flooding, these are the signs that we anticipated and our climate models hinted at 30 years ago.
And yet you just hinted at the fact that you may not believe we are past a tipping point. Why not?
Well, I personally don't. That's just the sort of scientific opinion. I think scientists are sort of at different places on that. But I will say that we're at a point of critical of urgency as I look around at what I see. I mean, I was at a conference one time and there were doctors in the hotel and I wondered why they were there. They were Canadian doctors. I said, why are you guys here? And they were like, well, we're here to learn from Americans how to treat Lyme disease. We didn't used to have it in Canada, but the tick that carries it can live there now because of the temperatures. Those types of things are happening now. And so it's important for us to sort of remove this notion that, oh, it's about polar bears or it's something 20 or 30 years from now. There's a reason the Pentagon and the military brass see climate change as one of its top national security threats now.
That is Dr. Marshall Shepard. He's director of the Atmospheric Sciences Program at the University of Georgia. Doctor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's our show for today, but of course, we want to hear from you. I know there are a lot of strong opinions about climate change and global warming. So what questions do you have about those things? You can call us and we will try to get the answers for you. It's 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk or on Facebook. And before I sign off for the day, let me take the last minute and a half to say thank you to Georgia, to say thank you to GPB. It's been 4 years since I moved down here for my first time south of the Mason-Dixon line. And Georgia has never been anything but warmly welcoming. I've never moved to a place, as a journalist for sure, where people were as warm and welcoming and kind at all times as they have been here in Georgia. This program on Second Thought is one that's really needed in our community to make sure that we're hearing Southern accents and accents from all over the world from our immigrant community and people who bring the issues of not just this state but this region onto the air to be heard and respected and discussed. That's the kind of atmosphere we've been able to create on this show. That's largely due to you and your support of GPB, which I hope continues as this show will continue. I'm moving on to DC. I am not removing my connection with GPB. I will be back. My love for the show, for the listeners, for my staff will never end. So thank you. Thank you to the GPB listeners. Thank you to GPB. And thanks to all of you out there who are hearing my voice. And farewell. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.